This week, we are thinking not about promises any longer, but the ability to critique the world that we find ourselves in, to call it for what it is when it blatantly moves out of the plan of God for humankind. To critique will make us feel like we are just being difficult or extreme when we are at odds with the values or the culture being practiced around us. We, the Western Church, have presumed, or maybe still presume, that the world and the people of the West still see themselves and still look at the world through our eyes, as though they were still part of or even shaped by the Church. So simply telling the world what is wrong with it, don't do this, do that, all of those sorts of approaches is neither helpful to them, nor does it advance the kingdom of God. The promises and the criticisms belong together. Each one alone and practiced alone eventually will lose value. If we are exiles, then we will always have a tricky path navigating our way through life, working out how and when to embrace and bless this world, while at the same time resisting it. I cannot pick and choose my moral high ground. We've referred for the last few weeks to the Old Testament exiles, and you'll find the exiles in the practice of critiquing their surrounding culture and empire. But they do it in a very clever way that we would do well to learn from. Daniel was told that there was a certain diet required of all people who would be trained at the royal court. Daniel does not make a big fuss about this, and there is no song and dance by Daniel. Daniel's resistance or his criticism at that level is simply to say, okay, I want to participate in this diet thing, but I want you to feed me raw vegetables and water. No fuss. I won't be giving you a Michelin star recipe that you've got to stick to. Just give me some vegetables, a bit of water, sort myself out, and let's see if it does me any harm. In that sense, it's Daniel downplaying the situation. He is not making a song and dance. Rather than an out-and-out assault on the king's menu, he offers an alternative way. He even offers a little cheeky challenge to see if he is less healthy. So his criticism is very subtle. His resistance to the culture around him is not to push and force his way against it, but to give alternatives to it. Rather than make a scene, Daniel's clever resistance allows him to continue in his own commitment to the values of another kingdom. He keeps his loyalty to another king. Daniel, while in exile, practices a dangerous criticism of the culture and still remains true to the values of Israel. Another example of Daniel's criticism of his surrounding empire and its practices is when Nebuchadnezzar is co-opted into building this incredible idol, a statue outside the city walls. Then he develops a system to go along with this new statue, that whenever or wherever the citizens hear the imperial orchestra play, they have to drop to their knees and worship this idol. If you don't do that, you get thrown into a furnace. Very simple, really. Daniel's three friends say that they cannot swear allegiance to this idol, and they will only swear allegiance to one king and only one king. We live in this empire, they're basically saying. We engage in the empire, we have our homes here, we work here, we have been educated in this empire, and we thank you for that. We are embracing as much of Babylon as we possibly can, but this is going too far. If you want us to bend the knee to this, I'm sorry, but we will honour you in every possible way, but this one area, we cannot honour that. The interesting thing is that when it becomes obvious to the king that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego are not going to bend the knee to this idol, they are then brought in to give an account of themselves. We will not bend the knee to you or to your idol, and that even if we are not delivered from the flames, we will not worship your idol. It's their decision already that regardless of the outcome, there are things that they just can't do or join in with. In other words, if we are thrown into the flames and consumed by that, so be it. We do not dictate terms on the basis of an outcome that is favourable to us. We will not bend the knee to that idol. You're basically at this point getting your finger and you're poking it in the chest of the emperor and you're saying, listen, not everything about your empire is despicable. We like parts of it. I'm enjoying all the good things in this great empire. But this I cannot do. This I will resist. This I cannot be part of. We know the story. they are delivered from the flames. But the fact of the matter is that there must have been thousands of other Jews who were not delivered from the fire. Christians right now, all around the world, they're sticking their fingers in the chest of their equivalent empire. They are saying no, and they are resisting, and they are refusing to take part in North Korea, in Egypt, in Syria, in Iraq, in Vietnam, in Sudan, and in many other places. They're saying, even if we are not delivered from the flames or the impending form of death used, whatever it is in those countries, we will not bend our knee to this. And many of them are not being delivered. That is the call of the exile. There are times when, by criticizing the empire and our culture or our worldview, that God miraculously steps in and we are liberated. In other cases, we will criticize the empire, our culture, or our worldview. In those moments, it can actually cause us significant harm, and we still make the call anyway. We do not make the call in light of a favorable outcome. We make the call regardless of it. We do not speak out on the basis of favorable comments from our friends, from our work colleagues, or from our housemates. We can hope for that, but with the lack of evidence for that outcome, we speak out anyway. What is the call on us as exiles? The call on us is to bless and participate fully in the culture in which we live, but also to resist and stand against that which is unacceptable and which is contrary to the things of the gospel. A reminder here, and this is important, that we need to spend time in the stories of Jesus. What you will see is that Jesus doesn't run around trying to get people to stop drinking, stop smoking, or stop whatever. He doesn't do it. What he spends his time doing is to try and set people free from religious control, from civic control, from physical and spiritual oppression. If that is the way that Jesus operated, if that's his agenda, then what is it that he's passing on to us? I believe that he passes on the same agenda. I believe that he passes on the same way of working. Let's look at one story of this messianic Jesus. First miracle in the Gospel of John is the turning of water into wine in Cana of Galilee. I want us to step back and look at the fabric of the Galilean culture so that we can better look at this story. Any Galilean northerner would have known that whenever his wife gave birth to a daughter, not to be disappointed that the child wasn't a son to pass his business on to, but at least a daughter could look after him in his old age. And so he would gather the village and he would celebrate the child's birth. He would draw out a measure of what was basically table wine and the vinegar-like stuff that it was that they drank at every meal. He would drain it off and set it aside somewhere. Then he'd do the same thing every year on his daughter's birth date. He'd do that every year until the year that she got married at, let's say, 15 or 16. He'd have 16 barrels of wine set aside for her wedding. Everyone knew that a good father would stand up at his daughter's wedding and would say, "For the last 15 years, I have readied myself for this moment out of love for you, my daughter." He'd pull out a 17-year-old barrel of wine. Everyone's lips would be quivering. There'd be saliva running down out of the corners of the mouth thinking, "Oh, the wine," which no longer has the quality of vinegar wine, but now it tastes incredible. They'd all drink from the 17-year-old wine and would toast the bride and toast the father that has loved his daughter so much that he would prepare for this moment. And then, like all good northerners, they'd work their way through barrel number 17 until it was empty. And then they would move on to barrel 16, and then barrel 15, and then barrel 14, and you know how it goes. So that by the time they've run out of wine, and I'm not talking about an evening reception here, but after days, maybe a week, maybe longer, of having been drinking, I would have thought a lot of them would have already passed out. And in Northern Ireland, we would call and describe that as carnage. Anybody still able to dance probably has a lampshade on their head, and the insurance inspector has arrived to deal with the damage claims. So Mary steps in at this moment. And now Mary has stored up stories of Jesus' childhood. I want you to note again the importance of the story of Jesus in the heart of a follower. All the clues and the reminders of who this Jesus is fire up in her mind a solution that involves her son. And so Mary, for some strange reason, decides that when everyone has already drank way too much, but still have space for more, this, she decides, is the moment after centuries and all the prophetic writings, she decides this is the moment that's probably going to be the best to launch my son as the Messiah of the world. I would question her timing, but I applaud the motivation in her. Jesus takes these huge urns filled with water and he turns them into wine, more wine than enough to lubricate an already plastered family, friends and village. This water in these urns was the purification water that would enable me as a good Jew to live in the world. And it basically meant that if I was going to do business with a Gentile and shook their hands and I made a deal with them, I would have to go climb into a bath and wash in this specially set aside water to make myself pure again so that I wouldn't have to be unclean like the world. Jesus takes the symbol that represents the separation between the holy and the unholy, the sacred and the secular, and he turns it into wine. He is saying that the holy, that's me, says Jesus, the completely holy, is actually shattering that which separates you from them. I am producing the medium for fellowship between the holy and the unholy now because of my work, and all of it and all that I have done will make holy through my death and resurrection that which is yet to come. This is the opening story of this gospel. It's interesting to jump on to the last story, which is the curtain in the temple being torn in two, that the holy can no longer be separated from the unholy, nor can the unholy avoid the holy of God coming in among it. Any kind of barrier set up to cause people to be in effect separated from will be torn down by my death and my resurrection, says Jesus. We therefore have a mission. We have a mission to bring the holiness of God into that which is unholy. We have a responsibility to make sure that the unholy cannot escape the holy of God. We become the people who copy our master, and we turn water into wine, that we will be relentless and we will find the barriers that separate the acceptable or the those who are in from those who are out. And we will do that both in our religious terms, and we're reasonably good at that, but also in secular terms. We followers of this Messiah will do likewise. We are to turn water, the barrier, into wine, which is fellowship or togetherness. So where we see any kind of injustice in our place of work or study, in our friendship circle, in social media, where we live and in our nation, we are seeing a barrier, which is the water. The water, the thing that we use to make us who we are and to keep us who we are. We take it and we break it and we change it into what it needs to be so that no one can have such privilege to be separated from anyone else or from God. Where we see behaviour that culturally esteems certain people over and above others, we have a duty to resist it. It is central to our commitment to disciple nations, to be missional in a city or a people group. It is central to be exiles in Babylon or our post-Christian world, to stand up for the values of Jesus, even if that involves criticising the culture of which we are part. I want to move on from that now and talk about, well then, how do we do that? Any community of exiles will obviously speak out against the values that Christ first spoke out against. And we cannot do it out of being squashed or being the minority. We do it out of a love of God, out of a love of something better. And not just once, and not just one online petition, not just one protest, but day in and day out to stand against values and decisions and actions that cause people to live less than they might otherwise be able to. Our gospel is a blessing. It brings blessing. We become blessed. A danger is that we misunderstand blessing or why we are blessed. The idea of having more in whatever way we say that more in our lives might actually be about taking away from someone else. The gospel invitation is not about having more. It's about laying down our lives and taking less so that there is something greater for everybody. To not have that as a criticism or as a filter may cause us or our Christian community to start to embrace more, to start to embrace the values that make the world tick so smoothly. They do not necessarily make us as Christians tick more freely and more smoothly. So when do we? How do we resist the values as Daniel resisted in his day? Would people know what the alternative is if they got to spend time around me, around us, or around our Christian community? We may be in a time of modelling another way or another world to the people we live or work among. It will involve us working for justice among the poorest of the poor. It might include our working against global or local structures that create systems where the poor stay in poverty and the rich get to stay rich. Are we willing to open up our homes for the good of others? Are we willing to share our cars, our wallets, our clothes, everything? There is nothing that we actually own. Everything is a gift from God and it still belongs to Him. So how are we using everything that He has blessed us with in order to make this world a better world? To bless it, but also use it as a statement to say, we will not be like this world. We know a better way to live. All this, or whatever you come up with, is a form of criticism of the current context of the way things are. It criticizes how cruel the world can be. Our positive action, our intentional lifestyle, will be a poke in the finger of in the chest of such a worldview that it will not be like this. It doesn't need to be like this. Too often we have practiced criticism as a negative telling off of the world, and too often it has been received in that way. In preparing this, I remembered a moment, shows my age now, of being in Northern Ireland on a Remembrance Sunday bombing in one of the towns in Northern Ireland. I remember the devastation on TV. I can picture it all. And a few days afterwards, about a week, I remember the father of one of the victims of the bombing speaking on TV. His name is Gordon Wilson. They interviewed him about the events, and he shares the story of lying underneath rubble and searching through the rubble for the hand of his daughter. And they hold hands, and she speaks to him, and he speaks to her. And she's checking that he's all right, calls him daddy. And then he remembers that under that rubble, that her grasp wasn't quite so tight, that the warmth in her hand was draining away, and that there was a quietness coming in her voice. And he realized that she was dying, until eventually there was nothing but silence and she had passed away. And they asked him, how do you feel towards those who did this to your daughter and to your family? He'd said, Gordon Wilson's Christian, and shared, really, well, what can I feel? Yes, justice needs to be done and I want that. But the thing that I can give to those who killed my daughter is forgiveness. I forgive them. I will not hold her death against them. I will not hold this crime against them. I forgive these people who did this. That news report went all over the world. And Northern Ireland, famous for its criticism of the other community within Northern Ireland in terms of the two communities being critical of each other, this was a new criticism that they'd never really heard come from Northern Ireland before. One that was actually positive, but it criticised the way Northern Ireland existed. And suddenly a voice speaks a different word. And it says, there is another way. There is another kingdom. There is another practice. It's the one that I'm going to take. It will be how I live. Those words of Gordon Wilson were the birth, the seed of the spirit of Enniskillen. They birthed, I think it was the Ulster Project came out of it. Both forums and both pieces of work of reconciliation, bringing young people together from across many communities. So his criticism wasn't a sort of telling off of the world. It said, I alone can choose this, but I'm going to live in a different way. And yes, you may not like it, you may not agree with it, but it's the way in which I choose to live. I think I probably should stop there. I assume you'll be glad to hear. Just to finish off by saying that it's easier to bless the world because the world loves being blessed. It loves the promises being kept. But no one is going to congratulate you for speaking out against the values that many people have come to rely on in our world. Our world and even our friends may not always celebrate or undermining the way things happen around here, the way things are mindset. You will not be congratulated for standing up for injustice against the environment. You will not be congratulated for standing up against multinationals or against any source of greed or abuse or bullying. We can expect resistance from our community, our culture, and maybe even other Christians because we start to practice a dangerous criticism. You will need to work out, how do I respond whenever those people actually that I even care about and they heap scorn on me, they laugh at me, or they tell me to be quiet, or I receive anger in return for my criticism. Some in the world today, this means physically suffering, torture or martyrdom. It is part of the call that we cannot control the reaction, nor can we decide only to be critical when we suspect that it might go well for us or be okay or well received. So even if I am not delivered from the fire of criticism or someone else's rejection of me, even if, then I must be able to say that I will not bend the knee to the kind of values that leave millions of people in this world worse off than I am. I will not be part of a culture that spending power or beauty equates to the level of my worth or the level of acceptance of any human being in our country. We need to have courage. It is the one gift of the Holy Spirit we should be asking for on a regular basis, so that we have the courage then to call out things for what they are. We need to have resolve and commitment to see things through to the end, to completion. We need to recognize that the empire is not fully the empire that dreams are made of, even though there are so many good things about it. It is not what it really could be, nor the one that Jesus asks for us to bring into being.